Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. On today's program, we continue our interview with the director of the Institute for Historical Review, Mr. Mark Weber. When we left off our talk last week, we were discussing the laws in Germany which make it a crime to doubt the Jewish Holocaust story. Let's rejoin that discussion now.
American Dissident Voices.
The German law is also very bizarre because a German court has held that statements that violate the German law, even if they're made in a country where such statements are legal, as in the United States, are still a violation of German law if these statements can be downloaded on the internet, if they can be read on the internet in Germany. That's the first count in the indictment brief against Ernst Zundel. He's held to have broken the German law on the basis of things that are posted on the Zundel site website that's based here in the United States, and which actually his wife runs, who's an American citizen. But that's considered a violation even of German law. Well, this is very dangerous, because if people could be put into prison on the basis of statements that are legal in the countries where they are made, but on the which offend the laws of some other country, a kind of international chaos could ensue. It could mean, for example, that someone calling for the end of communism in China could be held, making that statement on a website in, say, Sweden or Argentina, could nevertheless be considered violating Chinese law and subject to Chinese legal prosecution for making the statement.
Well, do you mean that right now an American writer, an American historian who questions aspects of the Holocaust story, should he set foot in Austria, Germany, Switzerland, or any of these other countries which have Holocaust denial laws, could be arrested in those countries?
The only country that has said that the statements are considered illegal, even when made in a foreign country, is Germany. A court upheld that for Germany. There's not been a similar ruling in any of the other countries I just mentioned.
What about the next step, which would be extradition, even if the person in question doesn't set foot in Germany?
Normally, extradition only applies if the same or very similar laws exist in both of the countries involved. So, at least for the time being, or at least in theory, a person would not be extradited from, say, the United States to Germany for violating the law, because the United States has no such similar law. However, that does not apply if the person is a national of that country. Ernst Zundel, for example, was a citizen of Germany, and so he was deported from Canada to Germany because it was considered he had violated German law in this way. But that's right, it opens a real Pandora's box, it sets a dangerous precedent here for even doing what Germany has already done.
Do you think we are seeing a high tide of these sorts of laws, these sorts of basically thought control from the Jewish power structure?
I know a lot of people have pointed to the events that I've just described in the last several months to say, well, this represents a new crackdown. I don't think that's really accurate. David Irving's conviction, or his so-called crime, was committed 16 years ago, and imprudently he decided to go to Austria knowing that there was a warrant out for his arrest on the basis of those statements made 16 years ago. So it's only a kind of a coincidence, as it were, that he was arrested in Austria and sentenced right now. He could have avoided that if he had just stayed out of Austria. In the case of Ernst Zundel, when he was picked up in February of 2003 in Tennessee, the German authorities and Jewish organizations wanted him deported immediately to Germany, but instead he was sent to Canada, where he had been living for more than 40 years. So as far as Jewish organizations are concerned, they would have liked his case to have liked him to have been put in jail in Germany a few years ago, 3 years ago. So it's only a kind of detour that he ended up in Germany when he did, and the case is coming to trial right now. And similarly, in the case of Germar Rudolph, the authorities have been playing cat and mouse with him for some months, and he had exhausted all sorts of legal avenues and was finally deported. But I think there is a kind of high point, because these kinds of laws are so unjust, they can only be applied and only survive when there's a lot of deceit and a lot of propaganda around them. The more people know about these laws, and the more they know about the case of Ernst Zundel or David Irving, the more people don't like it, the more people see the injustice of them. So in that sense, the Irving sentencing has actually done a service by highlighting these laws and their character. So I think, in general, there is a high point, a high tide has been reached. And now, having said that, the Holocaust campaign, as a propaganda campaign, as a feature of society, is still going, as much as Jewish organizations and Hollywood and so forth can push it. But it's harder and harder to really see an effect of this, because time is going on, and World War II is more and more a part of distant history for many people. Also, it's very difficult for to uphold this image of Jews as perpetually weak and innocent and victimized, when in fact the people who are being persecuted, like Ernst Zundel and David Irving, they're the real victims of this whole thing. And the country that is most eager to push for these laws, Israel, is itself a country that the whole world knows is guilty of just blatant crime, oppression, and so forth.
This brings me to another question, and that is the so-called war on terrorism, which to some extent at least has been a tool of the Jewish power structure, particularly the Zionist power structure. Who is a terrorist is often defined by which side you're on. And clearly, the Jewish power structure wants to define itself in terms of victim and its enemies in terms of evil, hater, terrorist, etc. How do you view the war on terror from your perspective, Mark?
After the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, President Roosevelt had come before Congress and announced that the United States was going to declare war on war, everybody would have thought he's nuts. But after September 11, George Bush came before the American public and said that he was declaring war on terrorism. Terrorism's a tactic. It's not something that one can eradicate. Terrorism is used and has been used throughout history by virtually every people that doesn't have state power. It's the poor man's weapon, so to speak. By the definition of terrorism that the United States government uses, the patriots of 1775 were terrorists. You know, the opening shots of the American War for Independence from Britain were fired at Lexington and Concord. And what really happened in that was that the British soldiers stationed in Boston went out to nearby Lexington and Concord to seize an illegal arms cache, caches of weapons in those places. And as they were going back and forth, American patriots just fired on the and killed the British soldiers who were just doing their job. And virtually every nationalist movement in history has been characterized by what the opponents of the nationalists call terrorism. The leaders of Irish independence in the 20th century, Eamon de Valera, Michael Collins, and so forth, were considered terrorists by the British and murderers. And when the United States was opposed to the Soviet Union's incursion into Afghanistan, the United States gave weapons to the Afghan rebels who were fighting against the Soviets, and the Soviets called them terrorists. One of the most famous of the Afghan or leaders who was fighting against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, although he was originally from Saudi Arabia, was Osama bin Laden.
Hmm.
And he was, maybe he wasn't a great commander, but the United States considered him a good guy when he was opposing the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, which meant blowing up Soviet tanks and killing Soviet soldiers in Afghanistan. But throughout history, this is how it goes. At least two or three prime ministers of Israel have well-documented records as terrorists. Menachem Begin, who was the head of the Irgun terrorist organization in the years before Israel became a country. Yitzhak Shamir, who was a leader in the so-called Stern Gang. He had a price on his head that the British authorities were willing to pay for anyone who could turn him over for his murderous acts. And they murdered British and other people. And, of course, Ariel Sharon, who even an Israeli commission found guilty or responsible for the terrible massacre at Sabra and Shatila during the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. But the United States has rolled out the red carpet on numerous occasions for these men who have well-documented records as terrorists or murderers or criminals or whatever you want to say. But so this, now we have this government that's claiming in the name of this war against terrorism, an open-ended war against whoever the leaders in Washington think we ought to be going against, and that now includes, of course, Iraq, and now they're gearing up for this war against Iran. But the American public, the more people know about history, the more they should understand just how threadbare, how deceitful these kinds of slogans are. I mean, it's very understandable that people were furious and angry after the terrible attacks on the World Trade Center, the 9/11 attacks, but what the Bush administration did was use that as a pretext for a war against Iraq, which has not served American interests, has not reduced terrorism, but served only Israeli and Zionist interests, and has made the dangers of terrorism far greater throughout the world. And this is understood by many, many more Americans with each passing month, and is understood widely all around the world.
Some wag said that George W. Bush is the greatest recruiter for Al-Qaeda in all history.
Yes. You know, to be cynical about it, for those people who were pushing for this war, it was already successful right from the very beginning, because it shattered the Middle East. It brought death and destruction and suffering to so many people. It destroyed it helped foment ever greater strife and discord in that part of the world. And that's been useful for Israeli and Zionist interests, because Israel's security depends upon the discord, strife, and lack of unity among its neighbors and among the rest of the world, really.
Well, those objectives were the unstated objectives of the war. In terms of its stated objectives, bringing the war to those who were responsible for 9/11, it's been very unsuccessful. We did manage to install a new government in Afghanistan. However, Al-Qaeda is still fully operational and very dangerous. We did manage to install a new government, although an unstable one, in Iraq, but Iraq really had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. So in terms of its stated objectives, it's gone nowhere.
Right. In the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attack, George Bush announced that job one was getting Osama bin Laden. Well, the years have gone by, and Osama bin Laden is still doing whatever he's doing and so forth. But instead, we've had this immense detour of an attack against Iraq, which has cost the lives of some 2,300 American servicemen, $200-300 billion, the lives, of course, tens of thousands of Iraqis, and has severely hurt America's security, its place in the world. There's probably never been such a blow to America's credibility as there has been as a result of this Iraq war, which is universally condemned around the world and increasingly condemned even here. But what's astonishing is, in the face of all of this, that the same people who brought us this fiasco are now propagandistically preparing Americans for a new war against Iran, another country that has not threatened the United States, that is no threat to the United States, and on the basis of similar deceits and lies.
I remember Wolfowitz saying this would be a 90-day war. Well, instead, it's a more than 3-year war.
Yes. any war against Iran would be a catastrophe. It's not merely that it would be an illegal war, a destructive war. It would be a war that the whole rest of the world understands is not in their interest. You know, a lot's been said about Iran in recent months by our government. It's pretty amazing that just the rank hypocrisy of the Bush administration about Iran. He denounces Iran as not being a democratic country. Well, he was a man who came to office in an election in which his opponent got more votes than he did. Iran has not attacked another country in more than two centuries. Iran has been itself attacked by other countries repeatedly over the last 100 years. In 1941, two allies of the United States, the Soviet Union and Britain, attacked and invaded and occupied Iran during World War II. In the aftermath of the revolution in Iran, Iraq attacked Iran with the help and connivance and support of the United States. But to denounce Iran as a great threat to world peace is not only untrue, it's amazing hypocrisy coming from a country an administration with the record that it has.
Well, I think Americans are weary of war, and clearly the so-called coalition of allies which brought war to Iraq is very, very shaky, if it even indeed exists at all anymore. It seems almost insane for the Zionist power structure to want to shake things up further, take more risk, and launch another much larger war under those circumstances. And it has occurred to me that the only way they could be thinking of this is if they were hoping or planning or had knowledge of some Pearl Harbor-like event like 9-1-1 happening again to galvanize the flagging support of the American people for such a war.
Yes, it is very hard to believe. I've talked with many people about this. Of course, it's all speculation, but you'd think that given the fiasco with the Iraq invasion and occupation, that it would be impossible to get the requisite support for an invasion against Iran. But all sorts of incidents can be created or can be exploited to try to engineer such a thing. And it is a very dangerous situation. One of the scenarios that's been talked about, of course, is that Israel may strike Iran, and then Iran would retaliate against Israel, and then the United States would claim that it has to protect its ally and is only going in to help Israel, and then that would escalate into a war. That's one scenario that's been talked about quite a few times. And there's many others, of course. Incidents can be created, and anyway, these are very, very dangerous times. But what's absolutely essential is to increase awareness among Americans about the origins of these conflicts, this war, to understand, not merely be against war, but to oppose those who are responsible for such war, and why, understand why they are pushing for war in the way they are. It's not enough to be for peace. It's necessary to oppose those who are fomenting war.
Well, let me play the devil's advocate for a moment. If the contention is that the Zionist power structure, that the Jewish power structure, wants this war in the Middle East, isn't that almost incredible, granting that the Jewish power structure is the richest and most powerful leadership stratum of any ethnic group on planet Earth, with very heavy dominance of the financial infrastructure of the West, with media power, with influence over governments far beyond any other similar group in the world today? Why do they want to shake things up as they're shaking them up?
That's a good question, and it's an important question. The answer is because as great as Jewish power is in the West, in the United States particularly, Israel itself, which is the Jewish state, is not a secure state. Throughout its entire existence, its security has always been a precarious one. It's required from the very first to today constant, continual infusions of huge amounts of money and weapons from the United States, but money from the United States and Germany and from world Jewry, merely to survive. That is the Achilles heel, so to speak, of world Jewry, that they are committed to a country that is so inherently unstable, whose status is so precarious. This is a country that does not have a constitution. It does not say what its borders are. It tries to uphold a status as a Jewish state when the demography is running against them. The birth rate of its non-Jewish population is growing much more rapidly than the Jewish population. Jews here in the United States that support Israel are willing to have Americans die and to tax Americans to support the state of Israel, but very few American Jews actually want to go and live in Israel. They want other Jews to go live there, but very few American Jews, for understandable reasons, want to go live there themselves. Yes, it would Jewish interests would be in many ways better served if there was no state of Israel, because it does require tremendous sacrifice and blood and money to maintain this country.
And tremendous risk-taking, it seems to me.
Tremendous risk-taking. It also, the state of Israel, just points up in a very dramatic way the double standard that Jews push around the world. They insist in every country where they live that racial and cultural and religious cohesion be broken down, and that people be regarded merely as individuals. But in their own country, in Israel, they insist that the specifically Jewish ethnic character of the state has to be maintained at all costs.
Yes, and that hypocrisy is beginning to show. Those who hate racial nationalism are calling Israel a hypocritical nation, and those who embrace racial nationalism are calling Israel hypocritical also.
Exactly. I mean, if a white nationalist says, we want to have in our country the same fervent and categorical championing and support for white racial interests in our country that Israel has for Jewish ethnic and national interests in their country, such a person is considered a Nazi, a racist, and so forth. But it also is dangerous not just for international Jewry, it's really dangerous for our country, for the United States, because we are supporting a state that in its policies is exactly the opposite of the ideals we claim that we uphold, and that we are even willing to kill and kill people for imposing in other parts of the world. It makes a mockery of everything that the United States claims to uphold, and makes a confusion and disaster out of our foreign policy. And the world understands this increasingly. That's why American credibility has never been lower, and why it will get even lower in the years ahead.
How do you read the statements and actions of the president of Iran?
I think that his predecessor, Khatami, was a more adroit and skillful leader, and understood the weight of his words when he spoke, the impact of his words outside of his country. Ahmadinejad, the new president of Iran, was the mayor of Tehran. He was a popular man. He's considered a man of the people and incorruptible. But he does not seem as measured or as prudent in the remarks he made. Now, one of the most one of the best examples of that is his statement that Israel should be wiped off the map. For many people around the world, that remark was construed as meaning that he wanted to kill all the Jews in Israel. That's not what he meant. You know, there's a very thriving, successful Jewish community in Iran itself. In fact, the Iranian constitution guarantees that one seat in the Iranian parliament is reserved for a Jewish deputy.
I did not know that.
There's a reserved seat for a Christian deputy and for a Zoroastrian deputy as well, because those are traditional religions there. But saying Israel should be wiped off the map does not mean he wants to kill everybody that's in Israel. Many countries have been wiped off the map over the years.
Nevertheless, it was probably not the best choice of words.
Right. It was not prudent to express himself in that way. President Khatami of Iran had lived for some years outside of the country. He lived in Hamburg, Germany, and he spoke German, and he understood much better, I think, than does the current leader of Iran, the effects of these kinds of statements on the rest of the world. Iran should be judged by its policies and by what it does, less by a few sentences taken out of speeches that seem to be directed mainly at the Iranian population itself and not for the world at large.
Ahmadinejad is one of the few world leaders who has openly questioned the Holocaust story.
Right. He went so far as to call the Holocaust a myth. And again, that's a statement that he should explain, or otherwise it's going to be just dismissed as the ravings of a madman by much of the world. When somebody says the Holocaust is a myth, most people think, well, you're dismissing the fact that concentration camps existed, you're saying that the well-known pictures taken after the war in the camps are not true, and so forth. Certainly that's not what he meant, but he meant that the Holocaust, Orthodox Holocaust story that we've heard of the systematic killing of 6 million Jews, that's presumably what he meant, but he didn't explain. And a statement that sweeping or that categorical is very easily misinterpreted, very easily misunderstood, or very alarming to many people outside the West.
Well, his main act in that regard seems to have been calling for a conference to research the issue.
Well, he called for several things, yes. The Iranian government has called for a conference, and Iranian leaders have asked permission from Poland to carry out an investigation of Holocaust claims in Poland. Poland's immediate reaction was to say that the archives and the sites of the former camps in Poland would not be open to independent researchers from Iran, which says something, I guess. But it's a very dangerous thing when political leaders pronounce on history. In any case, I think a stronger position for the Iranian leader to take in denouncing the hypocrisy of countries on the Holocaust issue and of stressing the way in which the Holocaust story and the Holocaust campaign is used to support and bolster Jewish Zionist interests than it is to make statements that certainly for many people around the world are going to be just dismissed as raving.
Was it adroit or a foolish provocation to call for a cartoon contest on the subject of the Holocaust?
Well, that was an Iranian newspaper has called for this cartoon contest on the Holocaust, and that's not an official Iranian government measure. That was done by just one newspaper in Iran. Of course, what Iranians are upset about and what they want to highlight with this contest is the double standard says that cartoons that are insulting to Muslims or even Christians are permissible, but images which Jews find objectionable are should be banned. And that's, I guess, the point of that particular campaign. But again, very often, statements made by some individuals in a country, or even some newspapers, do not necessarily reflect the policy of the government as a whole.
American Dissident Voices.
Be sure to join us again next week for the third and final part of Thin Ice, as Mark Weber and I discuss the new world we are entering. Is it the dawn of a post-Jewish supremacist age?